All right, welcome everyone to another episode of Snack Time with Mike and Ant. I'm one of your hosts, Ant Testator, freelance names and flavor text writer for Wizards of the Coast and writer for Gathering Magic. And with me, as always, is the flavorful Mike Linneman. But also with us today, we have a very special guest, the one and only Adam Staborski. Adam, how are you?
I like how you just completely glossed over like
I always
Mike introduction. Like, there's this Mike guy, but who cares?
I always do. That's my
Someone
thing.
Someone needs to be the hype man. That's fine. You know, he can wear the big clock. No big deal. The snacks.
Whenever we have a nice guest, I'm always like, oh, yeah, there's this Mike guy, but, oh, we have a guest.
There's this guy. There's a new person. Who is this? So, we could do in the whole spiel into me, but I write for Gathering Magic. I'm the art of the flavor duo here, and there's only two co-hosts among many hosts. You can find me, I'm usually known as Vorthos Mike, because nobody knows how to pronounce my last name. It's Linneman, it rhymes with cinnamon. But with us today is editor extraordinaire of Gathering Magic, among other things of awesome, Adam, the Stibs. Who are you? Who are you other than our editor?
I'm a writer for Wizards of the Coast, a contract writer, so I do Grand Prix coverage. Pro Tour coverage, and the Thursday column, Command Tower. So it's all about Commander and everyone's favorite 100-card format.
And you're on what podcast?
And I'm one of the three co-hosts of MTG Potpourri, joined by Tom Gustafson and Conley Woods, kind of a Monday Night Magic reunion trio. And we do very, very, very similar things to classic Monday Night Magic, but with a lot more Tom shenanigans involved.
Where's Tom from, P.S., just out of curiosity?
Minneapolis.
He is. My home, my city. He's from that same thing. Minneapolis magic scene, it's a thing. We'll hype it later. Ant, what are we talking about today?
Well, today we're going to dive into using flavor to help you inform your deck-building decisions.
Sprinkle it with taste, okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm all about that. Well, then kick things off, flavor gem.
Yep.
I'm going to start this one, because I never get to start it off. And while I am a spike, I like winning, you know, sports. It is American and themed. I actually did start out Magic playing, you know, flavorful decks. And I made Sapperling decks. They're terrible. Just awful. Used to go to the source and pick up the 25-cent box, make a bunch of Sapperlings, and get killed every single game. Every game. Turns out Armageddon was a big deal back then. Just hated the hell out of our playgroup. But I like the card Night Soil, mainly because Night Soil was the commander card no one knew about until maybe a few years ago, and they said, wait, I can pay one mana, get rid of things that I don't give a crap about, and put a 1/1 thing in the battlefield for basically free one colorless, and it's double green, all the Timmies come to the yard, and it has all sorts of different arts to choose, of which I like the new one by Richard Wright, because it's friggin' cool. I recommend playing Night Soul if you ever play green, because it's incredible, and no one blows it up right away, because they assume it's not that good. It's one of many games.
You know what I love about that card is that they kept the old-school flavor from Fallen Empires.
Oh, they totally did! They did! There's flavor.
They let it sneak in there.
Yeah, they're
totally... Of course there's flavor!
Alrighty, Ant, what do you got?
All right, so what I got today is Crippling Chill. It was recently reprinted in Khans of Tarkir. And I have this card in here mainly for the revamp and flavor that it got in its reprint, because this card was in Avacyn Restored, if you remember, and the whole theme of the card was locking down a creature because they were afraid of some ghost or this feeling of a creepy entity behind them, whatever. And in its reprint in Khans of Tarkir, it was given a different flavor angle in that a creature is totally frozen by ice. And this is something that I really, really like to see anytime that they do a reprint, because it enables you to utilize this same card in multiple different decks when they have different themes as far as like what their flavorful theme is. So if I want to build a ghost deck, I can throw in the Avacyn Restored version of Crippling Chill. But if I want to make, you know, let's say a Cryomancer or like an Ice Mage type of a deck.
What's a Cryomancer?
It's like a Pyromancer that uses ice.
Okay, that makes sense.
Mr. Freeze is a Cryomancer.
Yes, Mr. Freeze is a Cryomancer. That's right.
I like
So
it.
if I were to make a Mr. Freeze deck, then the Khans of Tarkir version would be the one to pick.
I dig that. I did. So you're in favor of this when it has the same name, same rules and ability, whatever, but it has new art and new flavor?
Yes, absolutely. I'm under the opinion that when you reprint a card, if it makes sense for the setting and you're able to totally revamp the angle that the flavor is coming from, absolutely do it. Because it just totally opens up the different types of thematic decks that you can put that card into. And it feels like a new card, even though it's exactly the same, just that different approach of, you know, freaked out by a ghost or frozen by ice makes it feel like a totally different card.
All right, that's fair. That's fair. That makes sense. I'll take that. Yeah. And the editor himself, Adam, what do you got for your flavor gem for the week?
My flavor gem is Epic Confrontation. This is one of the new cards from Dragons of Tarkir, and basically it's one of my favorite kind of flavorful cards. It's both a direct homage to Savage Punch. So Savage Wow. Punch was Sarkhan, like, punching a bear, which is, like, one of the biggest things you could find on, you know, the alternate timeline Tarkir. Now, in the new timeline, dragons are the biggest thing there are, so clearly Sarkhan has to punch that instead. And the flavor text kind of echoes that, and it's like, you know, any timeline, the guy's got to punch something awesome in an awesome way. And so I like it because it's obviously a great way to parallel the old Khans of Tarkir to kind of show, hey, the world's different. The same kind of things are happening, but the context has changed. You know, it's a little more interesting than, like, kind of just adding dragons to the background like they did on Summit Prowler. I thought that was kind of... You know, I like it, but it also felt kind of lazy. But, like, then you get, like, these really cool rich cards like Epic Confrontation. I'm like, cool, I'm on board with this. But then the other thing is kind of the meta flavor, right? So the idea is that in storytelling, like, there always has to be a story. And so, like, even though, like, this, it's a different universe now, and, like, Tarkir is different, and things have played out differently, and we're not sure Sarkhan has dad and mom anymore. Like, that's a problem, I guess. You know, they kind of point out, like, you know, in any timeline that we can go to, if you go to Tarkir and you go to Serac, he is punching things in an amazing way. And that's just always going to be there. And so it's like kind of like it's one of the few ways that, like, it kind of nods to the stories themselves. You know, like the meta of the storytelling in Magic, you know, it's in there too. And so I kind of like both sides of that.
It's a nod and wink to someone that says, oh, this is cool, it's the same art, and then someone says, no, this is actually has, like, 15 more layers below.
Right.
I like that. All right. Well, there.
Yeah, the one visual thing that I really liked with this card is that if you look at Savage Punch, Serac is throwing, like, a really hard left hook into the bear, right? But in this one, it's one-upped not only because he's punching a dragon, which is way more fierce than a bear, but he's also doing a savage uppercut this time, which in boxing would be way worse of a hit than taking a left hook. So it's kind of like, yeah, you know, he's fighting this thing that's bigger and better in a dragon, but he's also bigger and better in this alternate time.
He basically got a star in Mike Tyson's punch out, and he's going straight up. Right. Glass Joe, dead, intense, boom. Oh, I love that guy. I love Punch Out. Okay, so
what was that guy? What was the little dude's name?
Little
Mighty
Mac.
Something?
He's in the new,
Little Mac.
He's in the
right.
new
Little
Smash,
Mac.
And you can have one version where he's in the pink jumpsuit. So money to have him fight Kirby pink on pink. It's totally legit. Already had.
All I think about this art is it just reminds me of Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
So I look at this and I just see that little dude poking out of the corner going, "Toasty!"
Yeah, totally.
Every time you do an uppercut.
It's like that a Killer Instinct game that they're remaking again.
Right, and right.
We digress. So, flavor building tools. Let's just talk about this. How does this work? People have written some articles on this in the past of how do you use flavor to build a deck? And let's use Commander because, you know, it's a little more relaxed and you could probably integrate flavor maybe a little easier than a constructed deck. I should probably ask the Commander specialist here, Stibbs. Do you think flavorfully building Commander decks is the easiest way to integrate flavor?
I wouldn't necessarily say Commander makes it easier in of itself, but that Commander gives you a great starting point because you need to choose that Commander, right? You know, Commander, you know, for those that maybe have never heard of this crazy popular format that has its own product being produced and released annually by Wizards now, you start with a legendary creature, and basically all of your cards and lands, everything, are all in that creature's colors, whatever colors appear on that card. And you can only use one copy of a card other than basic lands. So once you choose a card for the deck, you don't get to add three more because it's a really good card for the deck. That's it, just one. So, and you also need 100 total cards, including the commander. So it's a big pile of unique cards, all kind of in the same colors. That's kind of commander in a very general thrust. So what I find is interesting about commander is that, you know, like any other format that you kind of construct and can kind of build around, there are a lot of different ways to tackle it. And one of the ways that I like to look at it is looking at what the commander does. Like, looking at if this was an actual personified living character, what is the commander trying to do? What are their goals? What are their ambitions? How would they go about tackling, fighting other people? That's kind of where you can get flavor in commander.
Back up a step there. So you're saying from the onset that there is this mechanical / flavorful infusion upon selecting a commander, even. Like, right away from the gun, it's what does he do, what does she do, and what can I make a bunch of things around that? And that maybe lends itself to flavorful builds?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the color identity rule, which basically is that rule that says, hey, you can only use cards and that have the colors of this commander, is flavorful as a rule, because it says, hey, if you are a blue-white, you know, legendary creature, you're not going to go grabbing some swamps,
right,
and throwing some drain lifes around. You're going to do things with the colors and kind of the themes and tools that you already have access to.
Right.
So while it looks like a limitation, that restriction actually makes sense given the context of what you have.
Right. And another part of it is, like, you know, for an example, let's use a legendary creature that just got released, Kolaghan, right? The Dragon Lord. Okay.
Yeah.
So
looks good.
She is a black red card. So right off the bat, you're making a black and red deck, right? But because of the nature of Commander, in that card is kind of the star of your deck, because no matter what game you play, it's always in your starting hand, right? And even if it gets destroyed, it goes into a, you know, pseudo zone where it's basically in your hand again. So it just makes logical deck building sense to pick other cards that are going to play well with your commander, because that's a card that you're guaranteed to have every single game. And Kolaghan's ability is that she gives all of your creatures haste, right? So that just lends you to wanting to include creatures that want to attack right out of the gate. And that is very flavorful when compared to Kolaghan and her group of, or clan, or whatever you want to call it, right?
Brood
would be a good word, right? Just the sheer fact that you're kind of like driven to want to build a deck that works with that legendary creature, it kind of leans you towards that whole flavorful deck building aspect without you even consciously knowing it, if that makes sense.
Whoa. So Commander, by the sheer essence, has a semblance of flavor built into it, and most people don't even realize it.
I wouldn't say most people. I think a lot of Commander players kind of get the flavor. They like building around their commander and kind of going all in on a theme.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But even what I'm trying to say is that even those players who like to build like the good stuff decks or whatever, they're still going to make those decks that kind of follow the mechanical theme of what their commander does. And 9 times out of 10, the legendary creature that you're using, the mechanics of that creature have some sort of flavorful tie into that creature, right? Because that's just the nature of legendary creatures. So in trying to build towards that mechanical identity, you're already kind of making a deck that follows the flavor of that creature, even if you're not consciously thinking, hey, I'm going to build a flavor-driven deck here.
That's sneaky. I like that. I've never thought about it like that. I mean, I've never quite thought that it's unconscious deck building. Like, even when I've tried to make a more, I don't want to say competitive EDH deck or a commander deck, but I want one that the game can end. I mean, eventually I'd like to play a second game, or eventually I'd like to get, you know, some pizza rolls or something in between, so that it's not just pumping out sapperlings and they're like, oh, I don't know what happens now. But if commanders seemingly, you know, where most people flake, well, we're going to have a bunch of dragons, we're going to have a bunch of rats, we're going to do a pseudo sub themes in that. Is it, I guess I don't do this in my constructed decks. Any sort of poison decks I have, I just grab things that look fun, they interact well together. When I played standard for all of 10 minutes, I didn't really think about it at flavorful choices. But I noticed in Legacy, people do it some, and especially in Vintage, to see this some sort of, you know, Vintage, you put all the good stuff in there, sure. And then there's definite archetypes. But with Legacy, it's, I want to play the burn deck, or I want to play the zoo version that's good because I like the animals, or I like the way it plays or the way it feels when I play it, which is Timmy-esque, but, you know, they make selections with artwork. I mean, you want the one Scavenger News by Dan Scott or not? Tarmogoyf, which one do you want? And then how it fits together as a theme. Well, I don't want all digital stuff. I want it all traditionally looking. Even with choosing the artworks in there is part of it, too.
Yeah, artwork and card frame, I was going to say, are definitely, I've seen a lot of discussion and sometimes, like, really terrible forum threads, just people arguing about, like, which island is, like, the perfect island for some deck. And it's all just about, like, the art and, like, you know, the evocative feel. It's, like, it's kind of like, you know, people that carry their draft lands around them, right? They've already got their land sleeved and ready to go. They got their sleeves and stuff ready all in their box for their deck. And it's like, do you use beta lands? Do you use full art Zendikars? I'm fond of the unglued lands, even though I love unhinged foils.
Sure.
The unglued basics for me just are really kind of like that primal, very different feeling land. I really like it. Some people will use like Tempest or Urza Saga. So it's just like that. That very simple thing, like even somebody like Marshall, right, who just doesn't do the flavor thing, like just like, I just draft decks and try to kill people. Like, he's got his beta lands, and like, he likes those for a very specific reason, and it's because like that the flavor of playing with like really old Magic cards, like this basic resource from like when the game was first printed,
sure,
still using it today, and it's going to kick your ass.
It's such a card frame discussion too. Like, I've noticed that when people start drafting more, like, it really is a learning curve that, oh, I get to save time because I have my lands pre-sleeved. But really, it's, you know, I just don't want sunflowers in my plains. I don't want that crap. I want purple skies. I need that all day. Or purple mountain mirage thing. John Avon, I need all John Avon things. And it seems to me, once people do it, draft maybe about a year or so, that they start to notice other people that do that, and they're like, wow, oh, I really like that other thing. And then they search and gather themselves to do this minutia of playing, but yet it's something they will always keep. And once you set those things, you don't change what lands you really, really love that often.
Right. I think it's interesting that the Eternal formats are more the ones where people start to care about the flavor, and I think maybe that kind of has to do with the fact that, you know, in those formats you can finalize your deck and figure out what deck you want to play and get all the cards, and then once you have them, you're kind of done, right? Because the format isn't going to change so drastically that you need to totally revamp your deck.
Unless they reprint stuff. That's the beauty. If they reprint, God, I don't know, Mana Drain as a Judge foil, which is like, oh my God. If they do new art with it, holy crap, Vintage is going to just go madness. Trading it. I want that new art. Oh, I want that old art. Let's trade new ones for old ones. I don't want that different Tarmogoyf art that they come out with. And it's this huge discussion on which friggin' art to use. And then they need the Korean foil, miscut crimp, or some sort of craziness to go with it, too.
Right. But you don't see that as often in like standard or I mean maybe more so in modern,
I don't know. We
but
should have, what about that? You do coverage for Wizards. Is there any format that it's pretty standard in that people pay attention to their flavorful builds and their micro choices? Is it more so Legacy and Modern, or is Standard doing it too?
I mean, I've definitely seen it way more often in Eternal formats, like Modern, Legacy, Vintage, that type of thing. And I think it's just because, like, once you get it, you hold on to it forever. Like, that's kind of like the idea is like, I want my deck to look the way I want it to look. It's where foil versions of cards and judge foils and kind of really limited rare versions of cards kind of come into play because it's like, I want them all to match and I want them to look good and I want all these things to kind of jive together and speak to me the way I want it to sit. I think it's just how much standard turns over. The idea of trying to till you build like the absolute perfect set of lands
Sure.
to go with your Jeskai burn deck, your Jeskai tokens deck.
It's gonna
It's gonna
rotate.
you're gonna have a new set, or the metagame's gonna shift, and you're gonna want to play something else. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just a function of like the effort to get to a point that you're happy with all the flavor and your individual choices on versions of cards and whether you use an old frame or a new frame for reprints. And until you settle all of that out, it just takes so much time and thought that you're already have to move on to the next thing. Just moves faster.
I hear something in that this turnover of standard will affect this. Did I hear that correctly? That by the very mere nature of it, if cards turn over faster, i.e. when they change the core set to every year, maybe people change their lands every year. Maybe they change their reprints every year of Naturalize or Shatter or whatever it is.
Think it's just return on investment, like just the time and effort it takes, you're just not going to get the value that you want out of it. You're not going to have a chance to appreciate kind of constructing this masterpiece, because
Sure.
you've got to play something else already. That's all. That's all. It's just,
Sure.
the effort.
Time more than anything, because my God, you know how long I get stuck in Gatherer searching for the right art by the right dude, trying to find the FNM promo or the arena land or that weird incinerate with the weird little logos on them. I mean, it takes me days. Like every time, I've only made Commander decks 4 times, and each one took me months on end. Picking art, picking the right flavor, picking the right version, trading to go from white border to black border, or all white border, which is super weird, but you gotta try it. And switching those things over with alters even too, which, changes that game
Yeah.
entirely.
That's one thing I will never understand is the altering to all white border. Like that
I think it's hilarious. I think it's so
just
trolly. I love it.
I just don't
Well, you,
understand.
so let's
I
be
don't
clear. The Magic
understand.
community is full of a diverse array of individuals with all sorts of personalities and temperaments. And among them, not necessarily I would say the most common, but perhaps the most memorable and therefore often pointed to, are people that do things like intentionally play lands in front now because of the
Yep.
reaction that it generates from onlookers and coverage and Twitch. People
Sweet
that,
voice.
before that I think it was erasing and making white borders because at one point there were core sets, and if you didn't have like an original printing of a card, your card was white bordered. And you often see that in modern decks, like even on coverage still, just like things like Sleight of Hand and things like that
Blood
come
Moon.
from older, 8th edition, 9th edition, and they're
Right.
white bordered. So people would alter and like, if you want to get consistency and you want to annoy all of your friends, you just erase the borders off your cards. It's just kind of like this legacy of,
So
it is a
ugly.
flavorful, artful decision to do that, and it comes with this
It
benefit
is.
of just tilting people randomly, which
That's
some people enjoy. I don't, but some people do.
a spiky Vorthos right there.
It totally
That's
is.
a spike. That's totally a spike Vorthos. Like, how can I use art to make people tilt? Oh, I know. I'll buy a playset of $100 Tarmogoyfs and then erase
Oh,
the
that's
borders. Like,
so bad.
ugh.
Or worse,
it just hurts.
They could alter over the top of it with white paint. I've seen that too, and it's like, oh boy, that's just painful.
But at least you can scrape that off. If you take acetone to the border, sure, you're just that's white bordered forever.
That's going to be such a thing in like 10 years is people removing altars. There was the big post on Reddit on like the My Little Ponies on the power cards. Did you guys see that? There was a full set of power with My Little Pony altered onto all of them, and the whole set was like, you know, 12, 13 grand or something. And I'm like, oh, why would you do that? But, you know, to each their own, I suppose.
So it's funny that it takes you so long to make a commander deck, and it takes me a while to make commander decks for almost the exact opposite reason, in that I'm not so much looking for the best art or looking for the card that fits, you know, the visual style that I want, but because when I make a deck, I'm trying to really, really narrow down exactly the type of flavor that I'm trying to hit. So, for example, if I made a Lazav commander deck and I wanted it to be all about assassins and rogues and being sneaky, I go out of my way to make sure that every single card – and Mike, you're shaking your head because I know this doesn't make any sense.
Even if it's terrible,
I go out of my way to make sure that every card in my deck is on flavor. And Adam can attest to this. We played Commander at PAX East, and we were desperately trying to beat an Eldrazi what was the commander of that deck? Krufix. It was a Krufix deck that was pumping out Eldrazi. And, you know, him and I were working together to try to beat this deck. And we're looking for removal, looking for some type of wrath effect. And we hit Venerian Gold. And he just gave me this look like, what is that card doing in your deck? And I was playing Tasker, and it was on point for flavor because Tasker had lots of money. So
yep.
I had a little gold sub theme going on.
It actually makes sense. It's actually really good in like that odd sort of terrible way.
So one of the kinds of flavor that I really like kind of talking about, like getting cards on flavor for a deck, is I like card alters that are on flavor for the card. And what I mean is like choosing something, if you're gonna alter the card, having it still fit the card itself. Like, you can put, you know, okay, I'll put Magneto on Karn. Cool, Magneto's a really badass guy who can move metal around. That's great. You know, Karn's kind of like an artificer type guy that, sure, okay. But it's like it's not like tight on flavor. So, like, next to my desk here, I have one of my first alters that I got from Eric Klug, which is False Demise, which is a Visions card. And, on it is basically the scene from Superman Dies, and it's where Lois Lane is holding Superman dying in her arms, and she says, "You stopped him, you saved us all." And so obviously, like, Superman dying didn't actually happen. He went into like a healing coma bullshit, whatever. Everybody's seen that video. It's amazing. But the punchline here is like, yes, it's on flavor. Like, okay, Superman's dying, but also, you know, he doesn't actually die. And so it's like, it's funny, it hits a humor note, but it still fits the actual literal card itself as a False Demise. And he comes right back.
Almost if you had like an Armageddon and there'd have like a symbol of the medieval plague or something, and you could see like a scorched town field, you know, utter destruction. And you're like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense.
Ooh, or Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck. That would be good. Armageddon altar.
A bunch of dudes drilling on a rock.
yeah. Oh my god, that would be amazing.
That'd be real.
We gotta commission Klug to do that. Can one, you just man. Say, or Steve Buscemi sitting on the rocket like a cowboy. That would be awesome.
That'd be so money.
Oh, I would buy that.
That's gonna get made now. I hope it does. Oh.
I hope so.
That's super funny.
That's cool. So what are some other – do you have any other examples of alters like that, or like, is that one of the only ones that you have? Like, I know one of the very, very first – this is going way back to the Magic – the MTG Salvation altered card thread. Cool. One of the very first images put up was a Black Knight card, and it was Alter Dev a Sketch of Batman on it, which – I mean, that right there.
Yeah, you saw the Monty Python one too for the Black Knight, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly.
My favorite altar to this day is still one. I think it was the second or third one that I actually commissioned Eric to do, was Fire Ambush. So it was a Portal 3 Kingdoms card. They were only white bordered. So that's one of the weird things about the set. So I wanted to get it black bordered, and I wanted to get it altered, an English version. So sent it to Eric, and basically it was, I asked Eric to do a lot of comic book panel recreation type stuff, because he has very, very detailed line work, real good attention to detail, and he captures the essence of like the comic book feel. Like, he can kind of mimic the artistry and the art that was put into that. So
that really brought him over the top too, I remember. Yeah, that was like his thing.
That was his bread and butter for sure. And now it's like impersonating art. Next, he'll disappear with a couple $100 million to Vietnam or something, because he's like big paintings or something. But anyway, when Eric was still just a small time imitator, I had him do Fire Ambush, and it was the panel from the Watchmen graphic novel where Rorschach is coming out with the bug spray lit on fire. And it's just like, it is the literal Fire Ambush in the stairwell, and it's just spot on awesome for that card.
And it has that extension too. So.
I let him kind of do the Planeswalker card for him to like bleed over a little bit. You know, I said, it's fine as long as the card text is pretty much legible. You know, that's one of the things with my cubes. Everybody has to be able to understand and read the cards, and I don't try to hide any important information. Right. But yeah, it was just awesome. I still love it.
You have? And
it's a bopper cube.
Which means what?
All commons. That's it. Just if it was printed in a common, or if it was published as a common in a Magic Online only set, those are kind of my eligibility requirements. Also, I go real deep and I look at, was it on a common print sheet in one of the early print runs? Because up until, I believe, the Dark, print sheets were really goofy, and so like things would be once on a common sheet, so they would be an uncommon theoretically in terms of availability, instead of having like two or three or four copies on the common sheet, but it was still technically printed as a common on that sheet. So that's where I snuck some things in, like Strip Mine and Mishra's Factory, because it was technically a common in the print run itself.
Dirty.
Yeah, we went deep.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Okay.
I just wanted more powerful cards there, and they work for that. So
okay. So we can use and integrate flavor into deck building. Obviously, Popper is fantastic for that, because you're limited by just by using commons. You have to find the weird ones, find the alternate printings. Was it an uncommon, but it was a common originally, and they bumped it up, or was it the right art with the right, year, especially in core set? What about flavorful formats in and of themselves?
What a beautiful segue that you set up just for yourself there, Mike.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
I'm talking about...
So are we talking about artist-sealed? Artist-sealed?
Iron Root Chef.
All right, Iron Root Chef. We can start with that.
I'm talking... So, Community Cup. This past year, they did a flavorful format called the Iron Root Chef.
Right.
And it was an intentionally flavorful format to do a curveball, to do a changeup for these Community Cup players that are so used to standard and boom and rocket and modern. And then it's, okay, if you know your deck, sweet. What if you have to build around some flavor? Can you be good there?
Right. Well, that was actually the second year, right? They did it before, right? Iron Root Chef.
Yeah, because Nate from Walking the Plains, like, teleplanes walked in for it.
Right. That's right.
But yeah, was kind of a unique thing, though. It's not like some people have, every Tuesday we do flavor draft, you know?
Right.
That's not that common, though I'm sure you could sanction it. Should look into that.
I mean, you could, but the hardest thing about the way that particular format was set up is that part of the judging was extremely subjective, right? You had a panel of judges who had to sit there and look at the deck list and say, oh, I'm going to award you X amount of points based on whether or not I feel that you made flavorful deck building decisions, right? And so any format where you have to have an outside judging panel in order to make it work isn't I mean, realistically going to be viable at a kitchen table. I mean, if you trust your friends enough to all be impartial and vote appropriately, then, like, yeah, maybe. But there's no way that you can have any type of a sanctioned tournament unless you had a dedicated judge panel, like a dedicated, this is the flavor panel, they're going to judge all the decks. Then maybe.
It's going to be a reality show. There's going to be Magic the Reality Show, like the last person standing. I can imagine now they could build it. Okay, well, the reason I bring that up is I wrote an article about this. We'll put it in the comments so we don't have to spend any much time on it. But there is an idea of the artist sealed idea of take every card made by an artist, so every card art they've done, and then make a deck out of it. And it has to be over 100 card art, so someone like Kev Walker, who has over 300, you can make an amazing deck out of it. Or someone right. like Ron Spencer has less, and it determines the power of it.
Right. But so basically the general idea is if an artist has 100 or more commissioned works for Magic, then you can pick them to be your sealed pool. And then you look at all the cards that they have ever done art for and create a 40 card or 60 card?
40 card.
A 40 card deck utilizing all of their commissioned cards as your sealed pool. So it's just like, you know, going to a pre-release or going to any type of limited event where you play sealed, only instead of opening six booster packs, you have a set, you know, 130 whatever cards that all are illustrated by the same artist.
So, and this idea came from Artmander. Have you heard of this, Adam? The idea that your commander deck can only use one artist?
No, that sounds terrifying.
Yeah, it's Artmander, and that the commander is unique. You can choose whatever commander you want. That's the one thing that can be separate. And then all of the card arts have to be by the same artist. And you have to somehow figure out how to make a commander deck out of this one artist thing. And I thought, well, that's a neat idea, but you still have the disconnect of, well, your commander doesn't really fit. So those two, and then the third one that's come about that I know of, at least from the art world, is original art collectors have these mini tournaments, like mini side events, in which if they own the original art to a card, that card can go on your deck.
What?
Yeah. So if you have the original sketch or original painting, you can put that card in your deck, and you have to build a 40-card deck. So you immediately can think, like, oh, my God, it's like $1,000 a piece. Are you freaking kidding me? There's no way you can make a deck of that. Well, if you have, you know, $30, $40, or $50 sketches, you can make a deck actually pretty quick. And this past year, a couple people played it, and they wore white gloves like they're handling art to play the format. And there's probably, you know, there's probably maybe 8 or 10 people that can play this now, but it's something that's out there, and I'm waiting for GP Vegas to see if people try it again. it shows it around right now. That you could use – some people say, let's see, we can use, you know, gold border or silver border or whoever it is into making this deck. And if someone has more than one sketch, like, I don't know, like Will Mirai, the South American artist, he makes a ton of them. You could use just one of the ones that works on his, like, the arm that they tried to figure out for Brainstorm. You can use that card in your deck then.
I got you. Okay. So Adam was holding up a sketch on the webcam there. What sketch do you own?
I own three sketches. One of the sketches that I own is the original alternate sketch provided by D. Alexander Gregory for Piana Nomad Captain from Odyssey. Nice. So
nice.
Yeah, so it's
you're gonna flip your wig over this.
You have you're the original art, Mike?
No, I don't. But I do have the other sketch.
Oh yeah, did you get it off of Craig?
Yeah, talk to me about it.
Yeah, Craig gave me the original sketch that was rejected, and I really like the original one because she just looks like She just looks like every badass that I've ever wanted to be growing up. Like, she's holding two scimitars, and like the dust is blowing, and she's like right in the front in the foreground. She's not kind of like back in the background with like an army around her. It right. really just is like her in like the craggy nomad type area that Odyssey was set in for the white tribe. It was awesome. I also own Steve Belladin's sketch for Geralf's Mind Crusher, which is just nice. The creepiest,
yeah.
creepiest
eyeball monster.
It's so creepy. It's awesome. It's just like so the art's really great because it's, you know, it's blue and it's like this thing coming through the wall and it's like, yeah, it's coming for you. But the sketch, because it's just so dark and graphite, it's just kind of like that comic book. You like your imagination kind of runs away with it. And then John Avon, who has done traditional work but also a lot of digital work these days, I have this sketch for R&D Secret Lair.
So oh, really?
Yes. Nice.
So there's no original for it, but I picked up the sketch off of one of the early eBay auctions that that guy was running a couple of years ago. So I have that.
A hell of a win. That's super.
Yeah. So
nice.
So it's one of those things where it's like, why doesn't somebody at Wizards own this? Well, I do now. Too bad. So nice. so pretty much I could make a deck that can play broken cards.
Yeah.
Like I can play interrupts.
Nice.
I
don't nice.
Know. Like I gotta play
you
the
can
cards.
Play interrupts.
I don't know.
You can play the original illusionary mask if you can grab that one.
Oh, totally. You'll
right?
have to talk to if you go to GP oh! some of the people there to get some sketches.
Stibbs, you got to get Ashnod's coupon so that you can make people get you drinks and make them pay for them.
Ooh.
Yes.
What you guys listening missed, sadly, was that Stibbs held up his sketch of Piana Nomad Captain, and it was framed, and it was matted, and it looked beautiful. And then Mike showed us his sketch, and it was just on a desk amongst a pile of other papers.
Sketches.
What the heck? It was totally just thrown on a desk somewhere. So
well,
I'm in the same boat. There's Mind Crusher.
Yeah. Well, I don't
frame,
I don't frame my sketches. And the reason being is I don't know how to frame them. I mean, if I have paintings, I do frame them. But I don't always do that with sketches because it's really hard to get the right light. And frankly, I find that if I want to get someone really encouraged into buying original art, I often offer them a sketch for, you know, whatever that at cost I got it for to get them started in thinking about, you know, oh, I would like that. And I've never seen anybody trade a sketch or bring one to a convention, but it would be a cool thing to see someone do that. Maybe a father with a son or a mother with a kid to say, hey, oh, yeah, sure, I'll trade some cards for a cool art I can put in their room and there's something resonant that they could bring home about it.
Right.
But I haven't seen it yet. I hope to. Which is your transition that you'd like right there, Ant, if you know, you could use it with new folks coming in, just saying. It's America.
Jeez. You won't even give me a chance.
Coming on.
The gloves are off, man, I'm telling you what. But, yeah, no, there's definitely something to be said there about, like, you know, whenever you're trying to introduce – I mean, yeah, it could be if you're a parent, but, I mean, this goes more broad to just in general, if you're trying to introduce someone to magic, I think one of the easiest ways to do that is through the flavor of the game itself. And one thing that I feel like a lot of people forget is that I would argue that every single Magic player, when they started playing the game, they were a Vorthos. Because there is a point in every Magic player's life where they have no idea what those mechanics do, what they mean, how they interact with each other. Like, they have no idea, but they're drawn in by the art, they're drawn in by the fantasy flavor, they're drawn in by the... Yeah, the wizards, the cool names, the witty flavor text, like that's what brings them initially like, oh, that looks interesting to me, I would argue, for the majority of players. And then once you get into the game and you realize like, oh, I can, you know, mess around with the mechanics of this card and create infinite turns and totally break the game. And you learn that Magic is a game about breaking its own rules and like that kind of interaction starts to draw you in deeper to the game. You start to maybe care about flavor a little less and more about mechanical interactions and whatnot. But it's really that kind of that first impression where flavor is extremely important. And one way that I've gotten a lot of my friends interested in Magic, including my own brother, is by crafting decks that lined up with flavor that I knew that they would like.
Okay. So what do you mean by flavor they would like? What does that mean?
All right. So for example, right, my younger brother, for years I've been trying to get him into Magic, wasn't interested, right? But I recognize that in every D&D game or every RPG we played
on the internet. You're talking D&D arcade game? Because I got that download on the Wii U. It's awesome.
No, I don't know what that is. I'm talking third edition Dungeons and Dragons or like Neverwinter Nights, Baldur's Gate, Skyrim, you name it. Any type of video game, any type of game, my brother always wanted to play an assassin every time. That was his thing, right? He's a lot like me in that way. I'm more of like the rogue, you know, setting traps, trickster type of a steal your, you know, purse of coins type of a player, whatever.
Okay, fine.
But he always wanted to be an assassin. So I created for him a simple 40-card deck that just had a bunch of assassins in it. Royal Assassin, the card Assassinate, really, really simple cards. Everything was just assassins, right? And he absolutely loved it, and now he's into Magic. And that's all it took, was that one deck that kind of bridged the gap to a flavor that he was already into, and that's what drew him into the game. It wasn't like a crazy deck with counters and oozes and dragons and all kinds of stuff going on at once. That went right over his head. But if I just gave him a deck that was, hey, you're an assassin, I'm a pyromancer, let's fight, he was into that.
Okay, so that worked for him, because you know him and, you know, there's family ties there. I'm trying to think when I've tried to teach people. And Stibbs, pipe in here, because you probably taught thousands more people than I have. I probably taught like about four. That I sometimes have to bring a bunch of varieties for people to try. Whether I'd bring a wizard deck and a dragon deck and a, I don't know, swag versus YOLO. I don't know. Like a singular thing that's easy to build. And I usually stole the Planeswalker decks that were made a few years. When did they start making those?
They've been out for a while now. I'd say, all the way back to 2007 was Elves versus Goblins. That was the first duel.
That was a while ago. My God.
But I mean, but that goes to my point, right? Like, what is the most common deck for a new player to make? Tribal, right? Why is that? Now, it is, and Rosewater talks about it all the time. New players are drawn to tribal decks.
Do you agree? Because I don't.
All right, yeah. What do you think that's a common deck?
Tribal decks. Do people start with it? I vote no.
I think in terms of people trying to build a deck that wins, one of the most common ways they approach that is looking at tribal decks, and that's because of the linear synergy that a tribe provides. So, like, if you have a whole bunch of guys that are like, hey, you've got these warriors, hey, if these other warriors help these other warriors, and then you've got these enchantments that help warriors too, and by the way, there's the spell that says warriors get even, you get this bonus because you have warriors, you put all of those linear elements together, and it just feels cohesive. You end up with it just comes out stronger. You know, you don't necessarily know how to build a great deck in the abstract. You know, you don't have experience, but taking all these linear components and chaining them together feels good because it creates consistency regardless of the individual ones you chose.
I would argue that on top of that, there's also a flavor component in that when you're starting out and you're deck building, it feels a lot better to build a deck where it's a whole bunch of minotaurs working together that buff each other up and smash your face than it would be to make a deck that played the exact same way, but all those creatures were totally different types. I just think that cohesive flavor of I'm going to build a deck where it's a whole bunch of soldiers and they're all going to work together and they're going to kill you. Like that, there's definitely a Vorthos component there that's just kind of flying under the radar.
So that came from the beginning. Did it not? 1993, straight up, I open my booster pack and I get a Crusade Rare. White creatures gain +1/+1. Gain +1/+1, which is hilarious. Will I trade Shivan Dragons to get White Knights? Right away.
Absolutely.
Built in.
Yep. But that's part of it.
I guess that's true. I guess. It makes sense. Like Bad Moon or any sort of like pump the team sort of thing or token generation. Like if you came in Fallen Empires, I mean, bless your heart that you're still playing the game, let's be honest. But you started to see this, all these things work together. I should get some more of this stuff that works together. Oh, I have a deck now. Oh, neat. Let's play.
Right. Exactly. But, I mean, you have to think, like, let's say you were starting a new video game, right? And you created a character, and your character's abilities were you could throw a lightning bolt, you could summon an ooze to attack with you, you could get a goblin to run out of a cave and, like, fight for you, you could, like, all this stuff that just was a total mishmash, didn't make any sense whatsoever. And then on top of that, you also had to learn the built-in mechanics of that game, like how to attack, how to block, how to do all this stuff. It's all not going to line up, and it's going to be so unintuitive for you to even learn that game. It's going to be harder, right? But if you come out of the gate and you're just a pyromancer, right, all your spells are fire-based, and those fire spells line up with teaching you the mechanics of the game, it's going to be much easier for you to understand that game and understand those mechanics. And then, yeah, later on, once you better understand the game, then you'll start to mishmash and pick what lines up best for you mechanically and what makes you the strongest character. But in the beginning, to teach you that game, the flavor is very important in lining up with the mechanics that they're trying to already enforce. So that's why I think that if you're trying to introduce somebody new to the game, having a deck that lines up really nicely in flavor is more helpful to them, because it removes that kind of confusing flavor aspect entirely and lets them just focus on trying to learn the mechanics. They don't have to also worry about why am I summoning an ooze and also throwing around lightning bolts, because that component isn't there anymore. All the flavor makes sense, and now all they have to worry about is, oh, how does attacking here interact with this enchantment over here?
So basically the concept of Duels of the Planeswalkers, of starting decks with a singular theme that a few cards unlock at a time. Oh, you get a sorcery now, or you get an instant speed spell now, is probably proven to be correct, I guess. Has that been tested? Maybe.
I mean, it's definitely, so it's definitely been said that Duels of the Planeswalkers is, I mean, one of the best ways to introduce somebody to the game if you can't play with them, you know, in person on a frequent basis. Like, I would argue if you want to teach somebody, like, if you can set apart the time to, like, sit down and play one-on-one in person, that's better, because then you can answer questions in real time and you can kind of help guide them and keep them from making bad habits or getting into, like, weird mistakes or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, the sheer fact that a Duels of the Planeswalkers deck, like, it starts you off as you pick a color. Those decks are usually really on flavor. It's like a Necromancer deck or like a Pyromancer deck or like a Garruk summons a bunch of beasts deck or whatever. And as you slowly, you know, get more cards for that deck, like it's that flavor is already there and it's kind of like ingrained in you and you're not even thinking about it. Like it's like subliminal messaging almost.
Okay, first of all, it's a necromancer. That's first issue.
Whatever. Necromancer, necromancer. Tomato, tomato.
First issue. But I can't ignore this. I'm sorry I'm the spike in the group, that it's so hard for me to, if I teach someone, that I'm going to have to, I don't know, shoehorn them into starting with demons or dragons or goblins first, instead of saying
it's not about starting with like demons or dragons. You're like, okay, you are a powerful wizard that can walk between worlds. Like, you don't start teaching magic to people like that necessarily. Like, some people it's great for, but like that doesn't speak to everyone, right? It isn't about necessarily the flavor. I think it's just the consistency of flavor comes from the idea of approaching teaching with simplicity, right?
Exactly.
You don't need to show them recurring nightmare and all the combos that it can do when they're just, you know, when just, you know, Zombify gets the job done. Like, they get it. It speaks for itself. It's that top-down flavor of, like, Zombify. I wonder if that just brings a dude back from the graveyard and makes it a zombie. Yup. You got it.
Yes. Exactly.
That big dude that you had to discard earlier, you get him back now, because that's what swamps do. You know, it's playing to what that color can do and exemplifying that with the most thematic, sometimes simple, but straightforward and easy to understand tools that color provides. I'm gonna drop a link in here and you guys can look at it later. But one of the things that I did early in my run on Serious Fun was share about a black deck that I made that I would use to teach people about the game. Because black was great because it had removal, it had evasive creatures, it had ways to get stuff back late in the game. It kind of hit all of the bases of things that you want, just a generally consistent deck that always has something to do to have. And then I just kind of expanded that idea out and built one for every color. And then when Return to Ravnica hit and Gatecrash hit, I built one for each of the guilds using two colors, because obviously, you know, you have that going on. You know, introducing the guilds is also a great way, because that's the newest thing. You always want to introduce with what's new, not with what's old necessarily. But it's just, you know, my approach was very much in line with kind of where Duels of the Planeswalkers goes and where the little 30 card intro decks go. You know, if you go to like a big convention, Wizards at like PAX or San Diego Comic Con, typically the swag bag will have like a sample deck in it. And it isn't that the deck doesn't have like powerful things to do. Like, turns out Nightmare in a mono black deck is pretty awesome, because you end up with an 8/8 flying horse at some point. You get a sense of what that color does, and it has a very much on-point theme for what you can do with the color, and it works.
But that's not how people come to the game. People come to the game by being taught by someone else, generally. It's not like, you know, you're learning how to play, I don't know, a video game, and you get to learn it by yourself. And you say, oh, yeah, I heard a cool review of this. I'm going to pick this up and try it.
And you go through that tutorial period.
It's the same reason Magic doesn't focus a lot in retail stores. Right. If you go to Target, you'll see stuff. But you don't see it like you do for Transformers, because that's where you get it. Most Magic players don't get their products in retail stores. They get it from the hobby shop, and they got invited there from a friend that they know. And that person is there to build them their deck. Here, bring $10. We're going to go through the common pile, and we're going to make you a deck.
Right. So then, if that's the case, and that I would buy that, that makes sense to me, then really what you're saying is it's not so much on Wizards, but it's on the community to make sure that when they're trying to teach someone how to play Magic, they're conscious of the fact that they should be picking cards that are going to be top-down resonant cards that are going to make sense to somebody who's never played the game, and not give them, like, here's Splinter Twin, I'm going to teach you how to play Magic.
I think it could be more at the store level. I really do. I think there's something about your friendly local gaming store that they often have the Planeswalker 30-card decks, which are grand, fantastic idea, but there isn't training, like, how do you teach a new player? We're going to give you ways to do so. We're going to give you cards to do so. They're not going to be expensive cards. They're basically worthless at the common level. But if you have a new person that comes in and you can clearly see older brother, younger brother, we're going to enable that to happen. And the cost there is near zero. I mean, really cheap. And we're going to try to encourage that on a global scale. You can't have it like the Guru program in that there's incentives with crazy high values. But that's the only thing I've seen that really plays into the actual behavior we use. This fun that becomes serious fun, ... Adam Branded TM, that they go from kitchen table, rubber band around their deck, white bordered weirdness that they took out of their older brother's pile of stuff, and eventually they go into the store and they try to make a deck out of it. They say, and hey, older guy with the two giant 4-inch binders, and the Gathering Magic playmat? Can you help me make a deck? And I'm like, yeah, I'll give you tons of cool green stuff. What do you got?
Right.
You know, let's go through stuff. I don't care. And that sort of interaction, there isn't really an entry point for people to do that, other than being, you know, good-hearted community members or being a great store owner. Yet. Oh, and Duels of the Planeswalkers, of course. That's an option, too.
Right. Yeah. That to me is where Duels of the Planeswalkers shines, because it enables that, like you were saying, like when you get a new video game, there's that tutorial period where you're just kind of run through, hey, this is how everything works. Before we drop you into the world, we're going to show you how all the buttons work. And Duels of the Planeswalkers kind of does that for you, where you start, they're like, pick your color, pick what kind of deck you want to play. We're going to teach you how everything works first, and then we'll drop you into it.
But that's too late, though. It's before that point. Where do you go from Clash of Clans, you know, grinding whatever the crap, into playing Duels of the Planeswalkers? Like, what is that linear approach? What is
I'm
the
saying,
way that
Duels of the Planeswalkers is the first, just that's the first thing. That's the first thing that you play.
That's interesting to me. That really is. I see people buying Commander decks and being like, hey, here's a thing and we can play this at lunch. And yet, that's actually a really difficult way to learn the game. Have you picked up one of the new Commander precons? Like, yes, they're very cool and they're very flavorful, but my God, are they difficult for a new person to understand. Super hard. Explain Doubling Season quickly. It's like, oh my God, this card's so hard.
Yeah, a brand new player should not be sold a Commander deck if their goal is to learn the game. I mean, whenever somebody asks me about Magic, right, because I do a lot with Magic and a lot of travel, and so, like, some of my friends and family would be like, you know, hey, what is this Magic thing? Like, can you show it to me? And I'm like, I can, but there's actually a really great way you can learn about it on your own and kind of see, like, kind of what the game is at a fundamental level. Because not everybody that's curious about Magic is necessarily interested in playing. That's something to remember, is that ultimately, like, if you want to look at it from, like, a marketing funnel type breakdown, where like awareness is the first thing, and like being conscious that Magic is a thing is already difficult. You know, there's a lot going on, and so like flavorful resonance kind of really helps play with that, because it's like, okay, cool, like I get zombies and I get, you know, dragons and witches and wizards and stuff, like cool, like oh, this is a game about those things. Like it is, but it isn't, and like we know it really isn't because of all the other stuff and how we've been in the game for years. But for somebody who's never seen Magic, that's part of the hook, is like, cool, like I love zombies, like wait, I can play with all the, like I can play with zombies, okay, cool, like let me check this out. So like that awareness is part of it, but then actually getting engaged, I point everyone to Duels of the Planeswalkers, you know, because one, the decks are flavorful and they kind of exemplify the different things that people right. like about high fantasy. They, you know, they run those home, like Duels of, you know, it's just like, oh cool, like the white heroic soldier guys, you know, and they go and like there's a whole bunch of them, and then they get like really strong when they're all together, great. Or I can be like the person that like kills people from the shadows and like raises zombies, and like cool, I'm like the sneaky powerful wizard, I like it. You know, so like that's, you know, that all plays together. But honestly, one of the things that's default Magic is that because it is so complex and so easy to make mistakes, I really feel that actually learning the game through like Duels of the Planeswalkers or through like a self-made rules walkthrough, like the little rules tip card that comes in the the little 30 card sample decks, it allows you to engage the game without somebody going, well, that's not how that works, or you're doing it wrong. Or, you probably shouldn't cast that spell right now. Like, that actually just totally irrelevant. Doesn't matter. Little mistakes, playing it wrong is fine. Yeah. Making sure that somebody doesn't feel shame for making a mistake is very, very hard to do in person, especially with friends. Because, like, you want to keep up with your friend. Or, like, oh, my friend thinks it's cool. Like, I better not screw this up. Oh, right. Whoopsie, I'm screwing everything up. Why don't we play this other game that I know that we can both play? Yeah,
that I will beat you at. Let's go play Call of Duty so I can kick your butt.
Yeah.
Yeah. I ran into that with my brother like the first few times I tried to teach him. And, you know, a lot of that was more my fault. And I was doing like, oh, I wouldn't do that. I would do this. Or, you know, maybe you don't want to do that, you know, type of language. And I could kind of see him removing himself from the game, like, oh man, I'm so much worse than him at this, like, what's the point? And he was like, screw it, let's go play Call of Duty, because he owns me in that all day, you know? But, you know, I think the fact that Duels of the Planeswalkers now, they're moving to a model where it's free, right? You don't even have to pay for it. It's kind of like a Hearthstone model, is an excellent idea, simply for the fact that now you can easily say, like, oh, are you interested in Magic? Download this free app and play around with it for a little while, see if you really like it, and then if you do, yeah, we'll get decks and play a game.
Yeah.
And that
free to play, something that I think makes it stand out in Magic is, like, there's an idea that, like, okay, cool, like, I've got to buy all these physical cards and they cost money, but if I want to play the game on, like, my iPad, I've got to buy all these physical cards and pay this money. Like, it feels very bad from, like, a consumer standpoint, right? Like I'm spending double here and I'm only getting, you know, really one game.
Right.
Being free to play lets people experience the game, get hooked, beating up on AI and unlocking cards and kind of getting into the whole, cool, I want to make deck better and better and better. And by the time you sit down with one of your friends who's, like, been playing for, like, 3 weeks and they just now, like, spilled the beans, like, yeah, I just can't put this game down. Now they're ready for that leap into, like, I'm going to commit my hobby dollars to this, and I'm going to go ahead right. and start building a deck, mm-hmm. and I'm going to meet you Tuesday night, and we'll do some pizza, and I guess, well, what's this draft thing I hear everybody talk about? That sounds kind of cool. Like you build a deck on the fly? Like, I've never tried that. You know, right. that hook comes from, you know, as you start moving down, you know, that marketing funnel, once they're engaged and they're coming back and back and back, then they can move to the next step and become, like, that repeat customer, that ideal
right.
consumer that keeps America afloat.
Right. Absolutely. And it's a lot easier to dive into a product that's purely digital too, because, you know, if you look at your friends who are all in the Magic and they have these, like, shelves of cards and stuff, like, that alone can be intimidating. But, you know, if they're like, hey, yeah, I'm looking at Adam. Adam's sitting here, he's got, like, shelves of Magic paraphernalia just, like, all over the place.
You like my Black Lotus?
Dude, I love Lotus. Your huge Juzam Dungeon. Or Dijin. Yeah. What is it? Dijin or Dijin?
Dijin. Dijin. Juzam Dijin. It's Martin Yuza.
Martin Yuza.
But, you know, when you have a new player and you're like, hey, I want to play this game with you, but first you have to buy all this stuff that if you end up not liking the game, it's just going to sit on a shelf and take up space or whatever. Like, now you can say, like, oh, hey, download this free digital product that if you decide you hate after 2 minutes, you can hold it down until it wiggles and delete it. Boom, gone. Forever, don't have to worry about it.
Wiggles.
And that's part of why flavor for deck building is just so important these days. Because you're looking at, you know, at least from Wizards, you know, my perspective from, you know, again, and obviously I don't speak for Wizards or know any Magic juju. I live in Washington, D.C., you know, whatever. But from the outside, from looking at the outside, like, trying to imagine, like, if I'm on the inside of Wizards looking at, like, how do I bring the game to more people? You know, you start with that high-level flavor, high fantasy resonance. You introduce them to decks that tie those linear themes and high fantasy themes together. And then you take a step further and empower those players to kind of tweak those themes and personalize them to how they want to feel. You know, the choice between, you know, a big, mean knight that's cheap but hurts you when it comes to play versus, like, a knight that you can, like, level up or, like, add +1/+1 counters to and get stronger the longer the game goes on. I'm going to build spells. I'm going to bring spells that let me summon a whole bunch of zombie tokens, or I'm going to play the expensive spells that let me get back my own dudes as zombies. I want to pick and choose and have right. better zombies to use. Like, that degree of how they choose to engage that flavor ties their decks together, you know? And once they're hooked, then they start just, you know, then it's like all bets are off. Like, I'm going to shove soldiers in my right. white-black deck, and I'm going to, like, oh, wait, I can play three colors with, like, this Constar Cure thing, and, like, oh, cool, like, right. dragons in every color. Like, yeah, I want a white-blue dragon. That sounds sweet. Like, who needs red? I've got a dragon that has hexproof. Come at me, bro. Like, that
right.
that as they get more and more and more engaged, as they experience more and more flavor, that's where I think people start to, like, it gets frayed. Like, it gets diluted what originally brought them in is now so widespread that they've just gotten into.
It doesn't even matter anymore. And people don't even.
Right.
Yeah. And people don't even. I think it's hard. Once you're at that point, like, I think that's where you are, Mike. Like, it's really hard. Like, once you just see all these different things for what they are and you can kind of mix and match mechanically, completely, you know, completely, you know, setting aside, you know, hey, you know, there's absolutely no reason this blue-white dragon would ever team up with this blue-green elf. Like, that's just not a thing that would happen. Like, the dragon would eat the elf, and we'd all be out of here. Like, five seconds, this transaction is done. But, like, in Magic, like, that's not how it works. Like, you get to do all these different gears and nuts and bolts and all the mechanics of it, but getting to that point requires experiencing so much flavor. You know, you forget what it's like to come in and just be like, I love the zombies. Right. I love to do these things.
And
then why not do a bigger effort with them?
Well, coming all the way back, though, right? That's what I really love about having reprints that are different flavor angles, because now that Magic has like over 10,000 cards, right, you can still build those extremely complex mechanical decks, and then on top of that, start coming back and saying like, I'm going to build this deck, but then I'm going to look at the art and I'm going to pick all the arts that look like it's ice instead of, you know, psychic energy, whatever. Like, now you have so many cards that are so similar that you can start to pick according to the flavor that you want your deck to be. So you kind of, you know, you started out and saying like, oh, I want to make zombies because I like zombies and that's why I want to be in this game. Then, you know, you get really into it, you learn all the mechanics, and now you circle back and say, now my deck is crazy with mechanics, but it also feels like a zombie deck. And, it, you know, you kind of can come back to that.
It's fair.
Have we beaten this horse enough?
I think we have.
No. Just smash it down with beat the dead horse.
Flavor is awesome!
Mike, we
build decks with flavor.
We've hit the horse with flatten.
The horse has been flattened.
Right by it. We're done now. We're not taking this trophy.
Let's go back and stomp on it some more.
Well, we'll have to revisit this if they make a cartoon or a movie soon, because that'll definitely change that paradigm entirely. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Dude, if they come out with a movie and they don't simultaneously release decks that say like, hey, you can play this deck and be just like Jace that you saw on the 50-foot screen. Like, I would be shocked if they didn't do that. That would be like having an Avengers movie and not being able to go buy like a Hulk themed deck or an Iron Man themed deck. Like, that just wouldn't make any sense. Yeah, or costume, whatever. But still, like
costly idea. Sounds nice.
Yeah, that would be sweet, right? Like little kid costumes at Party City, like Jace and Garrick and Najani and all that stuff. That'd be awesome.
I'd get a dog costume. That'd be so sweet. Oh, a man. A Johnny Weens. Oh, biscuits. That'd be great. Well, Stibbs, thanks much for entertaining us and teaching me more about the, you know, Commander, and mind-blowing now every time I'm going to look at a Commander deck and be like, you use a flavor and you don't even know it. Your face. I'm looking forward to those days.
Everyone's a Vorthos.
Well, secretly, quietly.
Closet Vorthos.
People don't know what the word means, but they are. They totally are.
Yeah.
Okay, so Stibbs, with you can find Serious Fun drops weekly on the Wizards site. You're there.
No. Serious Fun drops weekly, but that's Bruce Richard. I am the Thursday column Command Tower every week on dailymtg.com.
Okay, do you write it all for anywhere else?
I'm a content manager for GatheringMagic.com, so I handle wrangling you squirrels and a bunch of others that are awesome. I'm all over Twitter, the_Stibbs, STYBS, so I say interesting things and share probably a lot of photos of liquor when I'm at an event.
Yeah.
And I had some fun in Boston at PAX. It was good times.
Then he called me a degenerate, which was nice.
Because you're like, it's 8 a.m. Why don't you have a whiskey sour? I'm like, because it's Wednesday and it's a work day. What is your problem?
Why don't we have two? Why is yours empty?
That's not even a Magic card. Like, Degenerate hasn't been used yet. It totally needs to be.
I got that one in my back pocket. Back pocket for sure.
that's
And if you're a competitive player, I don't know why you're listening this all the way to the end. God bless you. But I'm often on the coverage team for US-based Grand Prix. So if you're around and you see me writing a bunch of stuff, I may look incredibly angry, but you can go ahead and say hi anyway. I promise I'll be nice.
Bitchy resting face. Yeah, my wife's got that too. She loves it. Ant, where can we find you?
So I'm, the easiest way to get a hold of me is on Twitter at AntMTG. I also write pretty much weekly for Gathering Magic, so you can, my emails are in all my articles. You can contact me that way. And that's pretty much it. Those are my two main social media situations for now, anyway.
If they Google your name, they totally find it. They just find all the yo aunt jokes there.
Yeah, they would probably see you berating me on Twitter. That's what they would
Probably,
find.
like, if that shows up, they're like, "Who are these people?" You can find me. I'm on Twitter at BorthosMike. My last name has a lot of N's. You just have to put LINN, add a bunch of N's, add flavor in my first name, and I pop up somewhere. But yeah, read some flavorful things. We have these things posted. We'll have some links posted too. But otherwise, thanks for stopping by and thanks for watching.